You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Mike Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. We're here this afternoon with Ishmael Reed, the author most recently of The Terrible Threes, but author also of The Terrible Twos. These two books are part of a projected Christmas trilogy, and among his other books are The Freelance Pallbearers, Yellowback Radio Broke Down, Mumbo Jumbo, Reckless Eyeballing, Flight to Canada. He also writes poetry, essays, has edited anthologies, has been the editor of a book series, I Read Books, which has introduced a number of new writers to American literature, to American readers, and I'm very happy to have him here in the station. Thank you, Ishmael,
Thank
for
you,
being
Maya.
Here. These books are, in many cases, satirical visions of America. They're kind of a counter-American history. And I thought I'd begin, since you are doing The Terrible Twos and The Terrible Threes, I'd begin by asking you about The Terrible Fours. How have they started?
The Terrible Fours hasn't been written.
Right.
But I've taken notes, and I have an idea of how it's going to begin, and I have a number of scenes in mind for The Terrible Fours.
But they're a kind of ongoing sense of the 70s, the 80s culture. In the middle of The Terrible Twos is a kind of vision of paradise where everything seems for a moment to be going perfectly right. Nola Payne, the Supreme Court Justice, has seen the error of her ways, and suddenly there's a sprouting of spirit everywhere. And you kind of root in an old 60s way for a novel to be able to end on bliss. Is there any promise of bliss in the future, either in the last book or in American culture?
Well, you know, I haven't made up my mind about how this trilogy will end, or whether it will be a trilogy or a quartet, a series of books that I will begin, and perhaps somebody will take up the responsibility. Maybe I will designate someone in my will to continue The Terribles.
Oh, that's
so
great.
So like the cathedral at Caen, which was built over a number of centuries.
That's wonderful. Joyce, who suspected that he might die before the end of Finnegan's Wake, said, well, if I died first, let James Stephens finish it. And everyone wondered, oh, Christ, Stephens writes stories about leprechauns. What is Joyce thinking about? Who would take over the reins?
My daughter has two books out, and she says perhaps you'll do The Terrible Ones. I can always tell whether a critic is acquainted with my work, because some have suggested that there has already been a Terrible One written. And so this is a phantom book, a book that doesn't exist.
You're another phantom in the book. The book is dedicated to Steve Cannon, whose novel will change American literature. As a bookworm, my ears perked up and said, who is Steve Cannon?
Steve Cannon is the author of one book entitled Groove, Bang, and Jive Around, which was published by Olympia Press, I believe, in the 1960s. But I've seen his notebooks, and I've seen a excerpt from a novel that he's written over the last 20 years he's been writing. And I think that he's the closest writer I know who's doing what the jazz musicians are doing. So I think this will probably be one of the most innovative works when it's published, to be published.
You and M.F. Beale, I think, are the two American contemporary writers who show up in Pynchon's Gravity's mm-hmm. Rainbow, probably, you know, one of the masterworks of this century. I'm kind of curious, do you feel any kind of consanguinity with Pynchon and the writers of that ilk?
No, I don't. I know. My name appears in Gravity's Rainbow, but there's no connection or there's no influence upon my work from his work or the other way around, I think.
Whose work do you feel close to?
Well, I don't know. That's very difficult. I think my stuff is a mishmash or a sort of a grab bag of different materials I see in American culture and European, African, and Native American culture. So I'm sort of like a scavenger work. I guess the idea of the raven or the trickster appeals to me, because many tricksters are scavengers. Eagles are scavengers, for example. You go to Alaska, Native Americans have a different vision about opinion about eagles than other people. So I think maybe that's what my work is. It's sort of what I do is I'm sort of like a garbage recycler, where I sort of reprocess the trash and the throwaways of the American experience and try to transform this into fiction.
You have been the exponent of something called Neo-Hoodooism. Mm-hmm. What is that?
Neo-Hoodooism is something in my research of folklore, what is called folklore. I found there were a number of stories called hoodoo stories in the oral tradition. So what I tried to do in the 1960s was to, and on through the 70s, was to use the style in my writing. And the more I researched the oral tradition, I found that this is a multicultural tradition, that the African slaves who were brought to the United States had a genius for absorbing materials from different cultures. And we see that throughout this hemisphere in the manifestations of Afro-American religion, that Catholic saints are included, Native American elements, Native American ideas, African ideas. So it's sort of a very cosmopolitan aesthetic. Of course, I didn't perceive it as such when I began my experimentations in the 1960s. But the more I've studied this, I found that this is an apt image for multiculturalism.
I was speaking to Frances Williams, a woman who was an actress at Karamu when the first black theater company in America, and then she moved to New York and was in the first cast of Raisin in the Sun, went to Russia and studied with Stanislavski, an astonishing woman. And she told me that she had come out here to Hollywood to be an actress. And when she arrived on the set the first day, I think the movie was Dolly Madison, she was greeted by Ginger Rogers and others, who immediately, she said, there was open arms. They came running up to me and said, Frances, can you help me find a chauffeur? I wonder whether, you know, in the Hollywood today, since Hollywood forms a part of so many of these novels, you see the situation as having changed.
I doubt it. I think I read recently, I think yesterday, that the women were calling for reforms in the Screenwriters Guild. And in passing, it mentioned in a paragraph that blacks were hired to write soap operas mainly, and there was a small percentage of blacks writing for Hollywood. That's obvious. So, you know, sometimes people who are outside of the Afro-American experience are called upon to interpret that experience, which leads me to believe that it's no longer ethnic. You understand, when it's accessible to a large number of people from different cultures, you can no longer dismiss it as an ethnic or vernacular experience. And so I think that perhaps the Afro-American experience is the mainstream experience. It's only ethnic when we do it. if you look at say a number of our prominent novelists, those who receive a lot of publicity, they use Afro-American styles and characterizations and themes. And so when they do it, it's not ethnic. It's considered mainstream writing. We do it, it's ethnic. So I think my generation in the 1960s, we were into self-help. And so I've turned down an opportunity. I don't know if it's an opportunity or not, or a curse, to write a number of scripts in Hollywood. I get phone calls once in a while. Just recently, somebody flew up to Oakland, where I live, to approach me about writing a television series based on the works of Langston Hughes. I read in the newspaper that they were going to do that, but I turned it down. I think that I'm really sympathetic with the independent movement among young black filmmakers, and I've begun a foundation in Oakland, California called Their City Cinema, mm-hmm. after named after Gertrude Stein's remark, there's no there there. We're saying there's plenty of there there.
There's there there
there's
now.
There's there there now, right. And so we just moved into a new building, and part of the preservation restoration development program, and plan to install a video center and also probably acquire equipment for not only instruction in 16mm and other technology. And I took a course 16mm. I figured if I could do it, anybody could do it. And I make it look easy, right? It's like Harry Carey singing "Take Me Out to the Ball Game." It's so bad. But so I think we're more of an independent movement. We're more into self-sufficiency.
Well, it's interesting. Frances, who's now almost 80, had gotten a role on Frank's play. She said that in the years that she'd lived here, it was her first role of any kind of seriousness. She played a conjure woman, which she does in life, too. Her kitchen is extraordinary. But she said to me, anything serious has to go on at home. And she started a theater, which she's had for 20 years in her backyard here in Los Angeles, where she has writing workshops, poetry workshops, and does plays. And her sense is that in a certain way, no one above ground could care less, and that's why, you know, the nurturing has to come from the community.
Yeah, we're not really interested whether they care or not. I think if you look at the standard fare on television, I mean, who wants to be engaged in that? And I always think it ironic that I worked in a university for 20 years, and it's ironic that blacks and others, you know, women and other minorities, so-called minorities, I'm not fond of that term. In this hemisphere, we're the majority. I'm, the average person in this hemisphere is Creole, you know. But they're always told they lack qualifications, and I think you have to be really a genius to write Leave It to Beaver, I guess. You know, I mean, if you look at the fare on television, they say you have to be geniuses to write for that. It just doesn't make sense.
I think geniuses wrote Ozzie and Harriet, and then the rest of them were all...
That's possible. That's possible. If you want a mirror of a suburban life in the 1950s, I guess Ozzie and Harriet, is that they all look...
It's almost scary when you see it now. It looks like something someone who'd been influenced by Beckett had done. The characters spend an entire episode looking for their keys.
Well, I noticed that Stephen King... sets the scenes for all of his horror movies in the suburbs. I guess that's the kind of stuff that's going on out there. But so we did a soap opera a few years ago, which was directed by Bill Gunn. This is a man who couldn't get work in Hollywood because he exposed the corruption that goes on in the industry. As a matter of fact, he wrote a novel which I published called Rhinestone Sharecropping, which deals with his experience of writing the script for a movie and as a result, not getting credit for it.
Mm-hmm. Was this published by I Read Books?
I published it. He died last month. The day before, I think he would have enjoyed the irony. The day before his play opened at the New York Shakespeare Festival at Joe Papp's Theater on Astor Place in New York, called The Forbidden City, which is still running there, starring Gloria Foster. This is a man with integrity, and he did several projects for us, plus not only two books, but directed a sort of a parody of a soap opera, which became much more serious than that, actually, as a result, or as it turned out, entitled Personal Problems. And it runs for about an hour and a half or maybe 2 hours. And it was honored by the Japan Foundation, and it was premiered at the Pompidou Museum in Paris. So we find there's a reception for our work outside of this country. And I think that the contemporary writer, who's really, especially black male writers who are being driven out of the market. I mean, it's amazing. I'm still standing. The guys wonder, why are they still, I feel paranoid. I'm still being published. It's amazing. There's a reception for Afro-American culture all over the world. Matter of fact, I think it's really, if only from abroad. I've been abroad several times in the last year. And only from abroad can you see how stupid and ridiculous this ethnic studies requirement, controversy, whatever you want to call it. It's back to basics. Controversy is when you view it from places that universities that are 800 years old. Mm-hmm. I was in Tübingen in Germany. It's 800 years old. They teach Afro-American literature there. And you think of anybody who was concerned about the survival of Western civilization, the Europeans would be. But they are very comfortable with our culture abroad. So I think unlike the days of the earlier Afro-American writers, especially the male ones, Richard Wright and Chester Himes and others, you really don't have to to gain the approval of your contemporaries in your own country, there's a huge, I would call it market. I guess I could call it market.
Why not?
Abroad. I plan to go to the Tokyo Book Fair if I can get there in February. And so we're trying to, what's the word, network.
Oh, dear.
Our bureaucrats in Oakland use terms like network. We're trying to communicate with authors in African countries, just as African countries, African writers are welcome here for different reasons. Writers from the Caribbean are welcome to American universities and have their plays performed. Right now there's a big fad about South African work. You know, although the Afro-American writers are shunned, they find that, and this goes across the board. My Asian American friends tell me that they prefer the establishment prefers dealing with Asian American writers and culture from the mainland. You know, right now this big China thing. Mm-hmm. But we have Chinese Americans living in this part of the country for six generations, and who've developed a culture and who produced the culture. So I think that now, with the world as small as it is, this global village, Afro-American writers and artists have to somehow begin to communicate with the planet.
I'm talking to Ishmael Reed, whose new book, The Terrible Threes, has just come out. Writing for you seems to be a kind of witchcraft. Mm-hmm. What is the conjure of fiction?
Well, that stuff has been used so often. I mean, in the 1960s, when I talked about conjure and magic and
necromancy.
Necromancy, I thought, you know, this is really original stuff. But now it's being used. I expect Gimbals or somebody to come out with, or some, you know, it's been marketed so much. I don't know if I'd say that. I think there's some uncanny things going on in my work. I think the reader has to read my work in order to understand this or to appreciate this. I don't want to be self-boasting about this, but I'm always amazed by some of the coincidences that occur.
Well,
for example, you mentioned Nola Payne.
Mm-hmm.
Who appears in the Terrible Threes, which, incidentally, if one wants to talk about a storyline, it's about the rivalry between two versions of Christmas, okay? Mm-hmm. The European version, which originated in Spain and has been popularized in the Netherlands and Germany and other places, and the American version, which is influenced by Protestant propaganda against the Catholic Church. In other words, St. Nicholas becomes a buffoon in the red suit in this country, whereas if you go abroad, like I was in Amsterdam the day of the first day of Christmas, which begins, I think, on December 6th, and St. Nicholas arrives into the city in a barge with these assistants called Black Peter,
mm-hmm.
Schwartz and Pete. And So this novel deals with the rivalry. I think both novels deal with the rivalry, the competition between this Black Peter figure, who doesn't enter into the American Christmas, and St. Nicholas. St. Nicholas does what I call geopolitical miracles. He interferes on behalf of statesmen and into the affairs of state and the government. And Black Peter performs what I call intimate miracles. So that's basically the competition that goes on. But and at the end of this novel, you see perhaps they have a common origin, okay? That they have a common history. But Nola Payne in this novel is about to advocate a bill to require that all infidels, all non-Christians, leave the country. Now, this book was available about 4 months ago, and recently I read that one of the Supreme Court justices, Sandra O'Connor, wrote an encouraging letter to one of these right-wing groups supporting their drive to make Christianity the official religion of the United States. And I think she was scolded for this in the New York Times, a long article. So, I mean, sometimes what happens in reality coincides with what one writes in fiction.
This seems like a good time to ask you to read from the preface to The Terrible Threes.
Okay. Well, the preface was written so that the reader of The Terrible Threes would be provided with some kind of background. Okay. And what happened was, in The Terrible Twos, a fashion model named Dean Clift after the death of a President General Walter Scott, the hero of Dominica, becomes president unexpectedly. He had no political ambitions whatsoever, and became a politician only because he was losing his body tone as
a
model.
He has a wife he calls Mommy who takes care of him.
He has a wife called Mommy, and he is a hands-off, sort of hands-off president, has a hands-off style, and there's this conspiracy being hatched among his staff called the TTs, or the Terrible Twos Conspiracy. And when I went to Switzerland, I was in Switzerland this June, and went to six universities there, and those people there said this foresaw this this book foresaw the or foreshadowed the Iran-Contra. It was easy. Okay, so I'll read a couple pages. The Terrible Threes begins on Thanksgiving in the late 1990s. It's been 4 years since the Christmas of the Terrible Twos, a Christmas which saw amazing events transpire in the White House of Dean Clift, former fashion model, who rose from congressman to vice president and then to the presidency after the death of General Walter Scott, hero of Dominica. Dean Clift was a hands-off president who didn't care to know about the activities of his advisors, Admiral Matthews, Bob Krantz, Vice President Jesse Hatch, and Reverend Clement Jones, the administration's spiritual advisor. Clift changed, however, after his wife, Elizabeth, the First Lady, was electrocuted while lighting the White House Christmas tree. And he was visited by St. Nicholas, who revealed to him the fate of former leaders who had made terrible and tragic mistakes. And St. Nicholas, out to remove his Protestant image as that of a buffoon in a red suit, also warned Clift of a covert operation developed by Krantz, Jones, and Matthews, codenamed Two Birds, a plan to rid America of the surplus people and wipe out an African country in possession of nuclear weapons at the same time. Nobody believed Dean Clift when he discussed his vision before a nationwide television audience, and the 25th Amendment regarding presidential disability was invoked to remove him from office to a private sanatorium about 50 miles from Washington. St. Nicholas, who had hoped to change the course of history, went back to the drawing board. Black Peter learns of an imposter Black Peter who gave the toy manufacturers a worrisome time during the Terrible Twos Christmas while a member of a sect which holds Nicholas to be divine. He emerges from Guinea, an island beneath the Caribbean Ocean, to challenge this Peter, Aristo Rasta, who has been living in underground Manhattan since the riot that happened during a Christmas party at Madison Square Garden, which was precipitated by Jack Frost and his goons, an employee of the toy manufacturers and Christmas card merchants. Nance Saturday, a wannabe detective to whom the clues are always ahead of, failed in his attempt to locate Snowman, a hitman hired by the gangster named Joe Baby to assassinate Boy Bishop, leader of the Nicolaites. Nance now drives a gypsy limousine ferrying customers back and forth from LaGuardia Airport to Manhattan. His ex-wife, Virginia, still has her television show. So what you have here is a mixture of American popular myth, European and Caribbean and African and Rastafarian machinery going on at the same time in just those two, three pages.
The Terrible Threes has just been published by Athenaeum, who've brought all of Reed's books, I think just about, mm-hmm. back into print, the rest of them now in paperback. In the course of putting together these raven's nests, jackdaw style of American history, black culture, there's a kind of doubling of everything, a kind of underground story behind the real story. Mm-hmm. And the character, Jack Nance, the detective, seems to be the person who brings together mm-hmm. all everything. Now, he retires to his own neighborhood and helps local people who've been in debt clear up their credit, mm-hmm. helps neighbors with problems. That seems to be, at least in this book, the only solution, the neighborhood solution to the kind of conspiracy politics and the international mumble, what would you mm-hmm. call it, mumbo-jumbo, really, mm-hmm. That's been going on. Is it, when you publish a book nationally with Athenaeum, is it like coming out onto the roof as a bellwether to announce the state of the culture? Are you the weatherman?
I don't think so. I have a great deal of, it's entertaining for me to write these books, and a lot of people find them entertaining, and there's a secret plot behind Humpty Dumpty set on the wall and Mother Goose, the Mother Goose stories, secret histories behind this. As a matter of fact, there's a new book titled fairy tales, subversion, the art of subversion of fairy tales. But, you know,
it's Jack Zipes' book?
I think so. I think you're correct. And I think if they want to read it as such, that's fine. But also there are other elements in it.
We have around 3 minutes left. I'm interested in knowing what's coming up from I Read Books and if you're still doing the Artbird Readers.
Well, I brought two books in my case here. I can leave them for you.
I'd like that.
Okay, one is by Yuri Kageyama, who's a Pacific Rim writer, one of the future style that I think. And she lives in Japan, but she also lived in San Francisco for about, I don't know, 10 years. And now she works for the Japan Times. And so her work includes, San Francisco culture of the 60s, Afro-American culture, you know, and all at the same time, it has sources in the Japanese experience. So she's one of the writers I would consider like a future multicultural writer who knows the whole area, this whole area of the Pacific civilization. And her book reflects that. It's also written in English. She's also a filmmaker. And I also recently published, just last week, a book by William C. Cook, who's a folklorist and a scholar at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. And I plan to publish a new magazine called Impudent.
Great.
And do some more projects, do some more film and television, and do some more record albums with songs and poetry set to music sung by singers like Taj Mahal did the first album. Bobby Womack did the second album, which is just Conjure 1 and Conjure 2, which was just released in Germany and Japan. It'll probably be released soon here in the United States. And I'd like to get George Clinton maybe to do the third album.
That would be great. You should get Shabadoo from down here to do some choreography for you.
Oh, terrific.
It's nice to have you here, Ishmael.
Thank you,
really good,
Michael,
to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I want to thank my engineer, Bob Carlson, and Melinda Siegel, my associate producer. This is Michael Silverblatt, and we'll be seeing you next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold, and books, 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 books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing, books tell you everything, they're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with a book off the mouse, wow.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.